Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
call will be starting in about 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or
maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you come online one day and you say, this happened to me today. The first person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at your remedies in the law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you, Martin, for your time and giving us this disclaimer. As you know, that we always start the call with checking on new people who have called in. We have a first-time caller from Shawano, Wisconsin, a phone number ending in 9127. May I have your first name only, please?
Yanni Ringo.
Hey! I know who you are. We're blessed, ladies and gentlemen. What we have here is the gentleman that was the lead investigator for the late Mr. Tony Davis. And I will, after I'm through with what I'm talking about and bring PJ aboard, we'll also make it available for Johnny Ringo to make a comment or two. So, with that having been said, we promised that we would talk about meets and bounds, and that will be the discussions for tonight and as well as next week. Meets and bounds are critical. What if I never told you about your history? And what if I lied to you for succeeding generations? How could you ever know what your history truly is or was? Fact is, you couldn't. You just have to trust me, so says the government. The whole model of your world would be a fabrication built upon a falsehood. There are clues, however, they are also ignored. They are never explained, and they're never questioned. The lie manifests itself to every greater proportions until it eventually consumes us. It's like that with the United States, whatever that is. It appears, however, it was supposed to be a city-state as opposed to being a nation-state with set boundaries. Over the years, the stone markers, they've decayed into obscurity. The border was never taught, and it was never observed. The stone markers decayed and fell into obscurity of, well, Orwell's memory hole. When I saw one once, everything made perfect sense. The District of Columbia was never meant to be exercising anything other than its own jurisdiction and never exercised jurisdiction over the states. It was meant to exist within 100 square miles of territory given by the states of Virginia and Maryland. To even a fool, the extent and intent of the boundary stone is clearly obvious. The United States only has jurisdiction within the 10-mile square. In almost every account that is not spoken of, or it is also then glossed over, the stones are located and described in detail. The ceremonies, though wholly Masonic, as in the Masonic Lodge, the Masons, they are described for posterity. But no one tells you what is plainly written upon the stone, that the United States is 100 square miles of territory and that the states are sovereign. In a treaty, the 1897 treatise titled Boundary Monuments, written in 1897 for Washington, D.C., on the chapter titled Boundary Markers at the end of page 3 and the start of page 4, the story is told, and I quote, "Each of the four faces bears an inscription. The face fronting Virginia or Maryland bears the names Virginia or Maryland, respectively. The opposite face, however, does not bear the name District of Columbia, but in bold capitals, the words Jurisdiction of the United States, all uppercase, Jurisdiction of the United States. That's what it says on the other side. For which reasons, I have heard these monuments spoken of and referred to as jurisdiction stones. This peculiar and unusual inscription is interesting and also suggestive. It throws strong light on the times and the temper of those ordering the inscriptions. The colonies had but recently emerged from a prolonged and bitter struggle for freedom. Each new fledged was therefore jealous of the freedom so dearly bought and was loth to have to give up any of its jurisdiction to any person, natural or artificial. When therefore jurisdiction was actually ceded to the sovereign states, but just united, exclusive jurisdiction was given to these United States with misgiving and reluctance to the extent of, quote, not to exceed 10 miles square, end quote. When the survey began in 1791, this territory over which the United States might exercise exclusive jurisdiction was nameless, and so was also the city to be created within it, which heretofore had been spoken of simply as the federal city. But when in the autumn of 1791 the survey approached or reached its end and a map or plot was to be made, the question arose as to the names. The three commissioners, who then formally resolved that it should be the city of Washington in the territory of Columbia, possibly, though, some of the stones were planted or at least marked before this conclusion was reached. However it may be, Columbia does not appear on any monument. But the more important fact is recorded that here, and here only, it may be added, the jurisdiction of the United States was at that time very absolute and unqualified. I would suffice it to say that the United States, whether as a corporation or a city-state, was relegated to the confines of what was known as the 10-mile square. And I would surmise the real cause of the United States Civil War was the usurpation of the United States exceeding these boundaries to the point where certain sovereign states finally said, enough is enough. True, the issue of slavery was the poster child. That was the selling point. But jurisdiction was the key. There was the Fort Sumter shot, and a long, arduous struggle ensued. The Union, or United States, was victorious in usurping powers it was never meant to have, and like a cancer, it spread through the state as tyrants and masters over all the states. The latest round in the perpetual Civil War is the mopping up operation. The United States wished to disarm the states for the final occupation. It used a psychological operation at a school to achieve this. It hopes to solicit your permission to destroy the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment. Hold on a second. Let me see something here. Yeah, we're doing good. And the plan is succeeding because no one knows the limits of federal authority. The stones are monuments to a history where a border was erased. President Obama has exceeded the mandates given to the District of Columbia. The concessions given to the bankers for a city-state are loath to consume the sovereign states. When push comes to shove, you will at least know which side of the line you're standing on by the jurisdiction it has. So with that having been said, let us turn the call now over to PJ, and we'll go from there. PJ?
Yep. Can you hear me good? I'm in the wind a little bit.
Yep.
Does it sound good? Okay.
All right.
It's just a slight breeze out here. Anyway, the 10-mile square area is the seat of government, and they're allowed to purchase land in any state that offered up allowed statehood. Statehood was let's say Nebraska, for example, would give a little bit of land to the federal government for military purposes. And the government that we talk of that is in operation today associated with the United States is the United States of America. And they have to own the property under that name, upper lowercase, the United States of America. The Articles of Confederation required it as the creation of the Union. And my experience is when I check out something that's absolutely federal, it is upper lowercase in the county records as the United States of America. In Omaha, Nebraska, it's the IRS building and the federal courthouse. It's the two that were the biggest pieces of land. And they are very close to each other, right across, almost across the street from each other. And so when we come to a piece of land that says the owner is anything else, it's not of the United States constitutionally. It's only a corporation. So when you find a piece of land owned by state of Nebraska, state of Nebraska National Parks, anything like that, I see no reason to believe that it's anything less than more or less than a corporation. And if it is a corporation and it's not on federal land, or if that land is not of the United States as ownership, common law is the jurisdiction there. So there is a jurisdiction there, and the highest jurisdiction is God. God delegates that jurisdiction to mankind that follow his rules. If you don't follow his rules, it's not yet delegated to you. And then the people delegate that jurisdiction essentially to the free inhabitants. And when they violate rights of other people, it goes into a common law jurisdiction, jury trial. It doesn't go to a United States court. The only United States courts, or state courts, have jurisdiction in those little islands of land, which is only 1.4%, I think, of Nebraska, that is actually considered land of the United States. I don't like to call it federal land, because federal is not it's not an accurate term, and it could mess you up. Just call it exactly what it's supposed to be. It's either land that is owned by the United States of America, or it's land that's not owned by the United States of America. When it was under, before land in Nebraska had a land patent, it was owned by the United States of America. The land patent is evidence that it's no longer owned by the United States of America, at least at one time in history. Now, they could have repurchased it, which they, you know, seldom do. But so if there is no land patent on land in the Louisiana Purchase, that means the government still owns it. Now, as far as how does that reach out and touch us, when you're traveling down the open way, don't call anything else other than the open way, and because they probably define highway, county road, all that stuff as a land owned by the United States, and you don't want that on the record. Excuse me. Anyway, you can challenge them to produce evidence that who is the owner of record, and owner of record is a direct correlation to land jurisdiction. If it's owned by the United States of America, the United States of America has jurisdiction, land jurisdiction. And if it's not, that means it's of American common law. Most 75% of the land in America is to be governed under common law unless a contract is operating, and that is still common law too. But if it's contract, you can still go to a common law jury and ask them to enforce the contract. Or you can go to a United States court, and they'll be glad to do it for you because they like to deceive people into thinking that they have control over a much bigger area of land than they really do. Nevada, they got 84% of the land jurisdiction. Connecticut only has 0.4%. Huge difference. So, Michael, are any questions popping up yet? Give him a moment to get his mic on. He might have stepped away
from the computer. We have Michael from Lost Wages that has raised his hand. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, good evening. When they incorporated that, they neglected to get full disclosure to the population of we the people, didn't they?
When they incorporated what?
When they incorporated the government.
Well, what else could it be? It can't be anything else. It's either the union is an entity. Now entities are created under by a higher power. Okay, so the United States is an entity that's been given permission by the people. The people are, in a sense, kind of like an entity. They've been given permission by God. But anyway, the entity cannot do anything more than the higher power can. But the higher power, the people of America, gave authority, and they call that authority a limited constitution. Their authority is constituted. It's confined. It's limited. If something is constituted, that means it's got specific parameters to it. And those parameters are found in the United States Constitution. Now, those parameters have to be, the Supremacy Clause requires that the states, what we call states, state of Nebraska, state of Iowa, state of Texas, Texas is quite a bit different than all the other states, but anyway, it cannot have any more jurisdiction than the United States has. And the Supremacy Clause reminds them of that at all times. Any state law has to be within the limitations of the United States Constitution. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So now they, when the United States owns land, they don't own it at the same level as the people. The people still, they get to use it. The people own it. Now, people own it until it's taken away from them. And we see that all the time when a country invades another country. They are no longer owner. It's taken away from them. So one military guy says jurisdiction is found at the point of a gun. And that's pretty much true. Thankfully, nobody's bringing a gun to me to take my land away today. Because I don't have a gun with me. But anyway, they do have jurisdiction, but it's limited. And that limitation is what I specialize in. When they come after you for a traffic ticket, that's a state written law, traffic ticket, citation, written law. They only have certain land that they can enforce that on. In Nebraska, it's 1.4%. They can't enforce it anywhere else. It's all a bluff. I've had them in court many times. I've had them bring in the city of Omaha. I'd subpoena them. Have them bring in the map of the city of Omaha, the map. There is no such thing. I've done it for years. There is no such thing. There is no map of the city of Omaha. There are plotted survey maps that the city of Omaha owns little land here, a little land there, a little land here, there, here, there. But there is no map. But when you drive close to Omaha, there's always the big sign that says, welcome to the city of Omaha. It's deception. So when they bring against, when they come against you with a municipal code, you can challenge them for the land jurisdiction. Now, if they don't have land jurisdiction, that means they cannot administratively prosecute you or tax you or govern you. It has, they have to, if they do come against you, it has to be in common law, which is generally spoken of as the Bill of Rights. So if they ever come against you for a traffic ticket and you're not on their land, and the Bill of Rights applies, and they have a whole bunch of trouble prosecuting you if they obey the Bill of Rights, because they have to disclose their jurisdiction, and they don't want to, they won't do that. I've had judges contact me and said, we used to do that. For some reason, we don't do that anymore. And I think the reason they don't do it anymore is because the Internet has taught a great many people the truth about the limited land jurisdiction. One interesting thing is, if you've noticed, the IRS is not prosecuting very many people anymore, if any, for failure to file. Very few. They're prosecuting people for filing inaccurately. Because the Internet's teaching people that if you don't file, they don't have any, a leg to stand on. But if you do file, they can come after you for entering false records into their system, which I think is a scam anyway. But anyway, I was told that recently, that somebody that was had a federal connection, worked for the federal government, said, we prosecute very few people for failure to file anymore. It's we focus on false filing. And then they throw that out there in the newspapers and make it make people scared to death of the IRS in every area. So, got another question for us?
Well, that's, the IRS is sort of like what they did with the Sioux Indians when they took their land. And now then they want to pay them for the land because the Sioux won in court. They virtually got their land back, but the government, the District of Columbia, wants to give them money, and they have refused the money. Now we want our property. And they're at a sticking point, and the government doesn't know what to do because they're not accepting the money for the land.
Yeah, there was treaties. If you ever study law, you'll see that they have a duty to not only to obey treaties, but to force other people to obey treaties. So if they have a treaty with a foreign country about shooting ducks or something, it kind of affects us too when the ducks fly here, I think, in some situations. It's kind of weird. But anyway, the Indians, I think almost all of them are considered a conquered nation. So the only thing that remains is a treaty. And a treaty is about as good as the person that's offering it. If he's got more power, he's going to abuse the treaty. But, you know, anytime you make a promise to your neighbor, biblically, you're supposed to keep it. So as long as it's reasonable, you know, if some idiot went out there and made a false treaty without the rest of the government being involved, that could be considered non-enforceable. There was an individual that did research in California, and he found an individual went to the big ranchers down way back. This is way, way back, early 1800s. And these ranchers had thousands and thousands of acres, tens of thousands. And he rode in there like a military person. He made a treaty with them. And then they signed it. And then they raised the taxes on the land, and they took the land away from the people. And he did research on it, and he found that the guy didn't have any authority to issue that treaty. That treaty never went through Congress. It was just a bluff. So he took these people's lands on a bluff. And when he was researching it, he was approached and said that he his life was in danger. He says if he continues researching it, it's going to basically be taken out because it was billions and billions of dollars of land. So just because it's on paper, just because it looks like a treaty, you can do an investigation because if Congress didn't vote on that treaty, it's not a treaty. It's something to consider. And then they have to be, there has to be a quorum there. There has to be so many people. A lot of weird things go through and get pushed. I think the 14th Amendment or something was pushed through on Christmas or something like that. But anyway, another question?
Well, no, they just do their best work at Christmas time.
Yeah. And, the best time to attack a nation is on their, the same day as their biggest holiday, usually.
Well, yeah.
It was Yom Kippur.
Is that right?
Yeah. The Six-Day War? When was that?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, I don't know.
Anybody else with questions? Press star 2 on your keypad.
Another thing we're considering is seems to have, and I didn't think it had much validity to it, but I've talked to some high-level people, and they told me that, yes, it is valid, is to get your documents in order, the truth of the matter in order, and take it to the Secretary of State, I think it is. Michael will fill us in more on it. And they actually give you a document that states that you're not a U.S. person. So when they do pull you over on the road, the document that you have or the magnetic reader, whatever card you have, they run it and they're basically notified that they don't have jurisdiction over you. If you ever noticed when the military goes into an area, and their boys are out there getting drunk. You could have 10 soldiers getting drunk and getting in a fight with 10 other friends of theirs that are not in the military in the same bar getting a fight. And who does the U.S. government arrest? Their persons. They don't arrest the other ones. They take their persons. Now, when they pull you over on a highway, who do they enforce the law on? Somebody they believe is one of their persons. So, I understand that we're getting these documents, a package that Michael is promoting with students and teacher relationships, and you can present them for probably everything that you're getting hassled with. You might be able to present it for property tax. You might be able to present it for federal taxes, for state taxes, for driving, for fishing license, everything. You got any comments on that, Michael?
Well, the thing is, it's not just that I'm promoting it, because that sounds so commercial. This is a tool that every information provider that we have has signed up to do or is wanting to sign up to do and hasn't got to it yet. This is so imperative that we're not accepting any new students. Not when I say we, the teachers are not accepting any new students unless they have corrected their status or it's in the process. It is a pivotal key for everything. When you litigate, when you go into court, whether it's traffic or whatever it is, I was always taught to make the appearance as special, a special appearance, because special appearance was how you could be there and talk without granting jurisdiction. And this is where you would fight the jurisdictional arguments. Well, prior to what we're doing with correcting my status, prior to that, we were just poking at things, pointing out obvious, flaws, like we talk about on these calls on Tuesday night, where different court cases say this about, United States citizens, but say that about citizens of the several states, et cetera. But we never had the leverage that we'll have with the status correction, not change, correction, from the State Department of the United States. I have people that, not understanding what's going on, they'll say they want to change their status. And I say, no, you don't. You're not changing your status. That means if you say you want to change your status, that means that what you had before was proper. And now something's changed, so you need to change with the change. And that's not what's happened. What you've come to the conclusion of is that you want to correct your status ad initio, from the point to the beginning. And you want them to correct their records nunc pro tunc, again, back to the beginning. Meaning that if, you know, let's say that you're 70 years old. I'm just going to make up some numbers here. You're 70 years old, and 30 years ago, you went to federal prison because of tax issues, et cetera, in your 40s. And, you know, you lost your not only you lost your home, but you lost your farm. You lost millions of dollars in farm equipment. And, you know, somebody in your family committed suicide and just all the horrible things that came from that 30 years ago. And you should have standing now, theoretically, to file a lawsuit against the individuals that did this tragic thing to you and your family, because at the time, 30 years ago, when you were 40, you didn't have standing to be in a class of citizenship that would be have a federal tax. It's as simple as that. So this is absolutely imperative. It just has to be done. You have, because if without changing your status, you're a federal slave. End of story. We have Harold that has raised his hand, so let's unmute Harold and see what he's got to say or ask.
Hi, Michael. Hi, hi. Michael. Hi, PJ.
Hey, PJ.
Hello. We got a. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. We got a friend that's divorced and has a 10-year-old son, and she would like to do. She hasn't started studying or learning about it yet. She would like to do. I've just been talking to her, and she'd like to do the correcting her status. She loves that idea. The question she'd have is, what would they do if she corrected her status? What does that leave the position of the son in? Would he still be a U.S. citizen, and could they take him away from her or whatever?
No, they can't. No, her standing as a parent is restored. As a federal citizen, which she presently is now, they can come in and take her child from her. Hold on a second. Give me one moment here. I got to bring this up. Where is it?
Yeah, if you're a U.S. citizen, they have authority. They have the higher authority than the parents with the children.
Yeah.
Bad thing. We had a individual that had a couple hundred kids taken from their parents in this one Mormon group in Texas years ago. And he just went in there and got the evidence together. It only took him a couple days to do it, and presented in federal court that they didn't have evidence that these children were a state property. And the judge let those kids all go, except for a couple that they wanted to do a little more investigation on, make sure there wasn't no sexual assault or something, anything like that. But 150 kids were let go within half an hour, I think, after those documents hit the courts. Mm-hmm. And they will maintain that that's their property until otherwise evidenced. So that's what Michael's working on here. The
okay,
people that
well,
Michael works with.
But then he remains, the child still remains a U.S. citizen?
at this point, yes. But the parent can, on behalf of the child, now that the parent is restored, on behalf of the child can prosecute correcting that child status as well. Because the correction is based upon the birth certificate.
Yeah.
The child can't do it himself or herself because the child is not of the age of majority. But the parent who has changed from being a federal citizen now to citizen of one of the states united under our Constitution, that parent can then make that correction.
For the child.
For the child. Wadley versus Newhall. Circuit Court, North District of California, March 13, 1905, quote, civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens, as parents, have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state, end quote. That should terrify every parent.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in court once, and I can't remember if it was a traffic ticket or a municipal code violation. Yeah. Well, anyway, and the prosecutor asked me if I was a U.S. citizen, and I said I have no evidence in my possession I ever elected to become a United States citizen. And the prosecutor turned to the judge and said, "Your Honor, I asked the court to have this man arrested because he's acknowledging he's a United States citizen." The judge goes, "We're not going to go that route." That prosecutor had the audacity, mostly out of ignorance, I believe, that he believed that, you know, he had authority to have me arrested for that very claim. So you're up against a lot of ignorant people in this area. And that's why it's so important to get this documentation, because they're not going to argue with the Secretary of State's determination. That is
okay.
That is pretty good evidence.
Michael, can you repeat can you repeat the name of that court case? Or
sure.
Your voice kind of faded when you were given the name of it.
I'll spell it. Wadley, Wadleigh. Versus Newhall, Newhall.
Okay.
This is the Circuit Court of the North District of California.
Okay. Thank you.
See when you go into court, with these documents, you're not going to be making a statement that you're not a U.S. citizen. The Secretary of State is going to make a statement that you're not a Secretary of State. That you're not a U.S. citizen. The Secretary of State's going to announce it through the paperwork.
Okay, got it.
Really puts them in, because every time you're in a federal court, especially they want to get on the record that you're a United States citizen.
All right.
I've been in federal court many times. Go ahead.
Let me give you another court case here, and I want to break it apart. Moore versus Illinois. Quote, every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a state or territory. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may be liable to punishment for infraction of the laws of either. End quote. All right, so first part, break it down. Every citizen of the United States. United States is a word, is a phrase. You can go to Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, 5th edition, 6th edition. It says the same thing. There are three definitions for United States. Okay? One is those who hold sovereignty with others. One who is the territorial citizen. And the other is the state citizen. All right, so it continues. They are also a citizen of a state or territory. Isn't that what I just said, definition number two and definition number three?
Yeah.
Continuing, he may be said to owe an allegiance to two sovereigns. May owe an allegiance? How could he possibly owe an allegiance to two sovereigns if he's only one definition or the other? He actually can be both. He can be both. He can be also a state citizen who is on territorial land. If you travel on territorial land, you're subject to the laws of the territory. No different if you were to travel to Mexico and you were to do something that was against Mexican law but was perfectly legal in the United States. You're going to be charged under Mexican law.
Got it.
Okay? So yep. He may. So it said that he owes an allegiance to two sovereigns and may be liable to punishment for an infraction of either of the laws of either. And that's how it's done.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, PJ.
Yeah. As far as federal taxes, it's just a huge thing. It's huge in American life. If you can cancel, I was making $15,000 to $25,000 a month, and I'd go right into federal court and tell them that I don't file federal taxes. I don't pay any federal. I don't file any forms for state taxes, and the government just walks away from me. They don't even set me down and say, why not? Because they know that I know how to keep the burden of proof on them. There are many ways they can switch the burden of proof to you and cause all kinds of problems. They've been doing this for hundreds of years. Got to be extremely careful. Almost say nothing in court.
Okay. Michael is next with a question. Your phone is open and then followed by Brent. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, on the jurisdiction, whenever you file do you file in the state where you were born, or can you file in another state, or does it matter?
Well, you're not filing anything in a state. You're using your birth certificate information. That's proof positive in government records that you're a citizen of that state. Your birth certificate is then sent to Vital Statistics. Vital Statistics makes their recordings. Then Vital Statistics forwards it to the Secretary of State of the United States, where they automatically put you into the territorial category. And once they've established their records there, you're a territorial citizen, they then forward your birth certificate off to the International Monetary Fund. That's who presently holds that pretty little piece of paper with your little tiny feet print and hand prints on it. Or in some people's cases, their hoof prints. That's the way it's done. So when you initiate this, there's two phases to this process. Phase one is just simply an affidavit that is presented to the State Department of the United States. There are specific posting protocols. There is specific departments, so you just can't go to the address of the State Department of the United States, because it's just like when you send something to the IRS, you're given a what they call a stop. After the address, you got stop here, stop there, and it takes you inside the building to the proper place it has to go. If you don't have those stop numbers in place, it doesn't get to where it's got to go most of the time. Anyways. Once that's done and the documentation has been returned from the State Department, then the second part kicks in. The second part is where I sit down with you on the phone. I'm online on the State Department's website in a special place we got to go, and I coordinate with you on the phone live to find the closest representative that the State Department of the United States has appointed to interview you. An interview is established. If you have if you do not have a passport, you need to bring in a certified copy of your birth certificate, not a photocopy, a certified copy. If you do have a U.S. passport, then you appear with, you don't need the birth certificate, you just show up with your U.S. passport if it's viable, if like less than 15 years old. If it's more than 15 years old, you got to bring in your certified birth certificate. There's a few questions that are going to be asked of you. You'll be well schooled before you go into this appointment. The appointment lasts 15 minutes. You have to be on time. No excuses. And after that, you'll turn in your passport, and I think they drill a hole in it or something like that. And then 2-3 weeks, 4 weeks later, in the mail, you'll get your passport, a replacement passport. It will look just like the passport you gave them, with the exceptions that the numbers associated to it or the scan features on it will tell them something different about you. Simple as that. It'll tell them that you're not a territorial citizen.
So my passport's only been expired for a year, so I can still use that then.
Negative. No. You can't even use the passport if it's still alive but expiring very, very soon. If you're at that close end of it, you need to have your certified copy of your birth certificate.
Okay. Well, renew my passport.
Keep your old passport because it'll help move the process a little bit faster. They just easier for an absolute identification of you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that clears that up. Thank you.
Let me explain the language on a birth certificate. The language, if you're born in Nebraska on Nebraska soil, it would say Nebraska. Birth certificate. If you're born in the state of Nebraska, which is a federal zone, which is land owned by the United States of America, it'll say state of Nebraska. State of Nebraska identifies land that is of the United States of America. So 100% of the birth certificates in Nebraska will say state of Nebraska. And almost all of them are wrong, because very few of those people were born on land that is of the United States of America. Very few. But they do it for money, for control. It's demonic, and that's the way it is.
Okay, next is Brent. Followed by Ron. Go ahead, Brent.
Yeah, I'm going to keep it kind of simple today. You guys were talking about traffic tickets, PJ, and you know that most of the land that's the highway or the interstate or the state route, whatever, or the county road is not actually county property. When they do their eminent domain and take over and put in a road, take people's property and put in a road, aren't they taking title to the property there? I mean, isn't that
nope.
land that's underneath the road
nope.
state property? That's my first question.
Well, in common law, they can take land, but they gotta give a just compensation for it. I mean, if you couldn't take land, you're gonna run a railroad across the country, and then you can't go any further because somebody owns a strip through the land that you can't cross. It doesn't work that way. But the government has some roads that they own under their name. Very, very few. But most of the roads, even the interstates, and we had a guy do an investigation on this, they gave the farmers, the prior landowners, a payment for perpetual use. Forever. So they didn't purchase it. They're just a perpetual use.
I have something to share with Brent here. Brent, do you have something to write with?
Yeah.
Okay. This comes to us by way of a gentleman that I did marketing for a number of years, many years. His name is David Merland. And he discovered this phrase, quote, open by right to public vehicular traffic. end quote. Open by right to public vehicular traffic, end quote. You'll find when you do your searches you'll find that it's the Department of Transportation that will be using this phrase.
Okay.
That applies to all your roads.
What does that mean?
Open by right, not privilege, open by right to public vehicular traffic. Means anybody can use it to go about their way.
Okay. So that's the first question. Okay. So then you're not really on federal land or federal property.
Nope.
So it's common law. So the next question is, if you're a state citizen, how is it that the laws of the state don't apply to you? I understand the whole federal U.S. United States thing, but it would seem that if you're a citizen of the state of Nebraska, and you know you have to abide by those laws that have been passed through their legislature and stuff.
It's the definition. It's the definition of the words.
Yep.
The word state there is not defined as a possession or territory of the United States. It's defined but go ahead, explain it. You got it down a little better than I do, Michael. Go ahead.
No, you're the one that taught this to me. How can I have it better than you? What PJ showed me is that, and it's in the United States Code. Give me a second, I can pull it up. But I'll pull it up after I explain it to you. The word state, the word county, the word city, all have been defined as territory of the United States. How about that?
Okay.
Just trickery when you're in court. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I'm going to your where it is real quickly here.
Yeah, usually when you look in the statutes, it'll define state, in this state, and this state. I've never found an exception. It's always, sometimes it's all three, sometimes it's only one. But it gives gives the definition for those, they call it a term.
Here it is, I found it.
And it's always defined the same way in all 50 states, possession or territory of the United States.
18 U.S.C. Section 31, definitions. Oh, that's, excuse me. Here we go. U.S., that's for vehicles. U.S.C. Title 1, Chapter 1, Section 2, quote, the word county includes a parish or any other equivalent subdivision of a state or territory of the United States. Did not say
yep.
And or, said or. So the a state is, there's in another place, a state is territory of the United States. County is a territory of the United States, and somewhere else you'll see city is a territory of the United States. So that's why
when you go to
when
court,
has, go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael. Well, when you go to court, if you have a hotshot lawyer, you got a rich guy that got a traffic ticket. I've seen this happen. You got a rich guy that got a traffic ticket, and the good old boy, he's part of the good old boy. He golfs with the judges and stuff. But when they get in front of the judge, they'll put on their case in front of everybody. But the attorney. The prosecutor will intentionally forget to state that it occurred in the county. And then he'll close his case in chief, and the judge will go, are you done with your case in chief? And the prosecutor will go, yes. Then the attorney, for the rich guy, or the popular guy, he'll stand up and say, Your Honor, he didn't state that it occurred in the county. And the judge will dismiss the case. This is how the rich people or the famous people or your buddies get off. It's all set up before trial. But everybody sitting in the stands, they don't know what happened. They go, oh, the prosecutor made a mistake. Boy, that guy's lucky. But that's what they do. That's how they That's how they stick the $500 ticket to you. But the other guy, his buddy, he gets off. It's horrible. They shouldn't be charging anybody, but it's horrible. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, no. You said it well. Brent,
yeah.
Is there anything else?
Well, just, okay, take the state of Arizona, for instance. It was statehood in 1911, I think it was.
No. Arizona became a state in whatever year you said. The state of Arizona came into effect in 1940 by way of the Buck Act. Prior to 1940, the phrase state of Arizona didn't mean anything. It was the same as Arizona State. But in 1940, under the Buck Act, the state of Arizona is a territory of the United States.
Was that a federal act or was that a state act?
It's a federal act, the Buck Act.
B-U-C-K, okay.
1940. Read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
The United States, they don't have a monopoly on definitions. So you can use the word state that can have a completely different meaning than what they have for it. So there is a state. State doesn't really mean much until you stick a definition on it. It really doesn't.
So you have a state
go ahead.
Constitution. You have a state constitution, and you know prior to statehood, there were county seats and all that kind of stuff, and you know territory, and it just seems like. It seems like there's a different entity between the federal government and a state.
That's what they want you to think. But remember, all state ofs is under the Supremacy Clause. What's that tell you?
Okay.
That they're subservient to the United States of America.
Now, I don't play the word state. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I wasn't going to say anything.
I don't play loose and free with the word state or county or any of the others. So if I'm in a legal situation, and it's been decades, please, since I've been in court. So, you know, I all I'm saying is that when I'm talking with other students, with their teachers, and we talk about Florida, I don't say the state of Florida ever. I might say Florida State, but then I quickly say, you know, like, comma, Florida being one of the, quote, collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution, end quote. And why do I go to that extent? Because I just nailed, quoted, definition number 3 in Black's Law Dictionary of the freely associated compact states, the free states, the union. States, if you would, when I said that. So I would never say the state of Arizona, but I would say Arizona State, Arizona being one of the collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. And I would, that's how I would phrase it in court, because I don't want to give anyone wiggle room.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
And when you go into court, you can present a plea for a traffic ticket or a municipal code. We have a package that we have together. It's called the Bill of Particulars, and it requires them to, as a matter of law, it requires them to unambiguous. Is that how you pronounce it? I can't even pronounce it.
Unambiguous.
They have to clearly define their jurisdiction. And how does it touch you as a person? How does it touch you as to the activity? How does it touch you as to the land? In which land jurisdiction did it take place? They have to clearly evidence that before the court can have the sufficiency of evidence on the record to proceed. Go ahead, Michael. Next.
And I would never use the word person. I would say, how does it affect the people?
No, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, but we have it written. We have it written out for them.
Yeah. Anything else?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you. Next is Ron, followed by Michael again. Go ahead, Ron.
Question on jurisdiction. I was born in Florida, but
hey,
I was
cracker.
Born.
You cracker,
I was
you?
Born. Yes, I'm a cracker. But I was born on a naval base. How does that affect my status?
It no more than it affects the people who are born in Washington, D.C. It does not, because you can claim any state.
Yeah. It really only has a grip on you until you turn the age of 18, and then you have to contract with the United States on your own. So it has no bearing.
Okay, but so I would be considered a Florida resident, right?
That's
no,
not it's not important. It's not important. They have to prove that you're a U.S. person. So it's really not so important that you have to prove anything. We send these documents in. They will give you the evidence that this guy has been researched, and he doesn't. He is not evidenced as a U.S. person. Leave him alone.
Okay. You never use the term resident ever. You strike that. You make it so that you. It's like the N word. I mean, I grew up in the South in the 50s and the 60s, and the N word was a common word. It wasn't derogatory. It was just, you know, the word. It meant nothing. It's been blown out for other purposes today. But think of the word resident as the N word. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox. Therefore, the United States citizen, open bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing. There's a key word, residing in one of the states of the Union. So it's telling you that you're from Washington, D.C., but you're living in one of the states of the Union. If that's what you're doing, then you're a resident. You're residing in one of the states of the Union. Hendricks versus Maryland, South Carolina reporters, quote, a U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident, does not have the common law rights of a citizen of one of the several states. End quote.
Yep, they're not supposed to. They're not supposed to give you a marriage license. They're not supposed to give you a driver's license because you're not a resident.
Correct.
They got to give you something else so that you can drive your semi or drive your car, and pretty much leave you alone. And this is kind of what this document does. I wouldn't be surprised you can jump in a semi and drive it, and they got to leave you alone. You still got to obey the safety rules, but. I would assume that's how that's going to work with semi drivers. Anyway, go ahead, Michael. We got any more questions? It's getting a little late here.
Michael's coming up, but Ron, are you finished?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Michael, you're last man on deck. Go ahead.
Well, one quick one here. I got my birth certificate. It's not on banknote paper. It says City of Salamanca over hospital. Then it says Salamanca on top of city. And then it has New York on top of state. That's my birth. I don't know what the state has or the state Department of Commerce, but that's the original with the footprint, mother's birth, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't mean anything.
It's just a record of a birth.
It's evidence that you are a New York citizen by birth.
Right. Okay.
You weren't born in Mexico. You weren't born in Germany. You were born on American soil. That's really what it does now.
Right.
All right. Anything else, Michael? All right.
No, thank you.
I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. I think it was a great call. Join us again Saturday with Judge Bernie on learning how to. Own property not own anything, but control everything. And then Monday is the nuts and bolts of how to acquire your Correct My Status program. So until then, good night, everybody. And PJ as well, thank you. Good night, everybody, and be
thank
well.
You.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.